Hello, and welcome to Airline Pilot Guy. I'm Captain Jeff, your host. And this time, I'm at home, in my home studio, which is actually my basement. And in fact, you may hear some sounds coming in from behind me in the room next door. My son just got up. It's mid-afternoon on a Thursday, the week right after Christmas Day. We're in the first week of Christmas. And anyway, obviously, home from school. And now he's just started playing his Xbox 360, so might hear some sound effects from that. Anyway, the reason why I'm home is basically I flew a lot at the beginning of the month of December, and I timed out. Our contract allows us to fly a certain amount of time per month, and I did it all before Christmas, and so technically I'm off for the rest of the month. And I do have a request in, though, for some overtime flying, what we call green slip flying, which is paid at a higher rate. And I'm allowed to pick that time up, even if it carries me past the maximum allowed amount of time. And we're talking about contracts here, not the FAA maximum time rules per month. So I'm nowhere near the FAA maximum, but anyway, I guess things are pretty much under control. They have everything filled and covered at my airline. And so I've been at home since, the day before Christmas. I got back from my trip and been home ever since. And I've had a great Christmas so far. How about you? I hope you have. I recorded on my birthday, which is the day after Christmas, a Catholic Pilot episode dealing a little bit about personal things and, our faith and references to that. So, and also answered a question by Matt, that asked about how I handle, balancing my work and my family and guy time. So if you're interested in any of that kind of stuff, check out Catholic Pilot. That's catholicpilot.com. And you can sign up for the feed there. If you do, you'll also receive the Airline Pilot Guy show, which is what you're listening to right now. Anyway, it is Thursday the 29th, I believe. Let's see. Let me look at my calendar. Yeah, the 29th of December. I'm home in my basement, and I've gathered so much feedback and so much stuff happening in the news here that I felt that I couldn't wait until I was back out on a trip. And the other thing is that, chances are I may not be flying again until mid-January because for some reason I bid vacation for the first 2 weeks of January, probably because I didn't know where else to put those weeks, and that's just where they ended up. And I probably had the idea in my head that I would somehow be able to move those to a more significant time. And of course, I completely forgot about doing that. So January, the first part of January through about the 14th or 15th, I'm not sure exactly when my first trip is, but sometime in the mid part of January is when I'm back out again. And I didn't want to wait until, I couldn't wait until then. Too much to talk about. I'll probably go out to California to visit my California family, my mom and Ernie and my sister. I'll probably do that right after the new year. And maybe even pop out another one of these podcasts before I head out on another trip. But enough of what's happening in my personal life. Let's get on with the show, shall we? First thing we need to talk about is the new rule that was just released by the FAA last week, I think the 21st or something like that of December. And it's the new FAA rule to combat pilot fatigue. Now, many people are lauding this new bill, and it has a lot of good stuff in it. Now, I must say, at Acme, my fictitious airline, legacy airline name that I use for the company I've flown for now for over 23 years, we have a lot, our contract is pretty good when it comes to protecting us against working too many hours and too long of a duty day and that kind of thing. But, we're, a lot of people out there flying for other carriers are not as fortunate as we are at Acme to have such a great work rule in effect, or work rules in effect. And so this new rule by the FAA really, you know, came a long way toward kind of evening out the playing field for those airlines who didn't have such good work rules. And so that's a good thing. And it will actually affect ACME and its scheduling somewhat as well. So it, a lot of the airline groups, one of the industry associations representing the airlines is saying that, you know, it's very happy with the new rule and that kind of thing, although it's going to cost somewhere upwards of $300 million for the industry as a whole to implement some of these new new work rules. But not everybody is quite so happy. In fact, some people are claiming that the whole thing has been politicized too much, and that the airlines had too much of a say as far as you know, how this whole rule went. In fact, let's see. There are some critics that say, let's see, for instance, John Nance, you may have heard of him. I believe he was the NTSB chairman for many years. And, you know, you see him a lot on TV. I think he's on ABC a lot, I think. I'm not positive about that. But John Nance is one of those folks that is on record for saying that he's not very happy. ABC. He's an ABC news consultant. He's not very happy with this new rule. He's a former Air Force and airline pilot. Says he's angry about the new rules and called them abysmal. And this is quoting John Nance. I'm very distressed over these rules because they don't go anywhere near far enough, and they bear the earmarks of having listened to the whining of the airline industry. We've needed comprehensive change in our duty time controls for fatigue for a long time, and this just ignores about 25 years of research. Let's see. While the here's John Mica, the representative from Florida. You know, he's the one that introduced the bill to initiate the Transportation Safety Administration and the new security procedures that have been in effect since 9/11, or since shortly after 9/11. And of course, now he's quite vocal in saying, I think that was a mistake, and he's trying to introduce legislation to at least scale down, if not completely eliminate, the government's role in security and kind of transfer it back into the civilian realm. But anyway, this same John Mica is quoted as saying, while the final rule provides improvement for aviation safety, pilots must take personal responsibility for coming to work rested and fit for duty. The government cannot put a chocolate on every one of their pillows and tuck them in at night. Well, okay. Yeah, John Nance is rightly a little upset about this whole thing because, you know, purportedly the whole reason why this thing got really, you know, accelerated was after the incident in Buffalo in 2009. You know, that Colgan Airlines flight that crashed in Buffalo, killing, I don't know, nearly 50 people, I believe. Both the captain and the first officer were commuters, and I believe the captain had spent the night in the crew room at the, and what that means is just a like a lazy boy chair in the crew lounge before he reported for duty. And the first officer, she had flown in all the way overnight on an all-nighter from Seattle, and so both of them were commuters, and both were fatigued before they even stepped in the airplane to begin with. And so a lot of people out there, including John Nance and others, who were hoping that the FAA would address this whole thing regarding commuting. But unfortunately, there's really nothing in there at all about commuting airline pilots. And I know from my own experience, if you don't get a good night's sleep, you don't perform at your peak. And I've witnessed several times where I've been flying with co-pilots who one day are, you know, very sharp and on top of everything. And then the next day, I can tell that they just haven't had a good night's sleep because they're missing radio calls and just doing kind of odd things. So that's why there's more than one of us up there in the front. But anyway, so that is one of the problems with this new rule, that it doesn't really go far enough in addressing, you know, what we're going to do about commuting pilots. Now, I can say this because I'm not a commuter. Maybe some of you listening to the show who are airline pilots are commuters, and I know you're sensitive to these issues and you don't want to be overly restricted when it comes to you know, what you can do as far as planning for trips and you know, making sure that you're well rested and such. I'm not a commuter, so it's a little bit different perspective for me. The other group, one other group at least, maybe many more, who are not very happy with these new rules are the freight dogs, the guys flying for UPS and FedEx and other cargo carriers. They were basically not covered at all by this. And, you know, a lot of people would say that these people are the ones that are really suffering from fatigue. They're flying mostly backside of the clock, you know, in the middle of the night. And they were eliminated from this whole consideration in this bill. And I think that was because, okay, why? You know, when you hear about air crashes in the airlines with passengers dying, that's big news, right? That's front page headline news. Every time a FedEx airplane or a UPS airplane crashes, you don't hear anything about it, or very little. I mean, there might be a little blurb, you know, on page two or three that this happened, but guess what? There weren't any passengers on board, and just boxes. And that just is not as sensational as, you know, passengers, innocent people dying in these accidents. And so that's just the fact. And the fact that the cargo pilots were not included in these new pilot fatigue rules is not a surprise to me. But I am outraged by it as well, because you know what? They face the same or worse conditions that we do as passenger carriers. And they, you know, carry, not only do they, you know, fly big airplanes, but they fly them in and out in airplanes around the rest of us who are carrying passengers. They fly over cities and towns and populated areas. There are many aspects of a cargo pilot's job that do affect directly the public. And to just kind of, you know, kind of bury your head in the sand and pretend that these rules really don't apply to them is ridiculous. And I'm quite outraged by it as well. So we have the UPS Pilots Union is suing the FAA over the exemption from the rest rules, you know, saying that the FAA yielded to unprecedented industry pressure when it exempted cargo airlines. Let's see, who else? I remember reading something about the FedEx pilot group as well. Let's see, I'm trying to get my mouse to go up on this page, but I can't get it to work for some reason. Sorry about that. Let me try this. There we go. Oh, nope, I guess I didn't clip that article. Interested in your take on these new pilot rest rules, especially those of you out there flying for the regionals and the other big carriers or not so big carriers. Let me know what you think. Again, I think I'm going to see very little impact at Acme Airlines and as far as how these rules are applied. And again, also the international realm may be affected a little bit more so than the kind of flying that I do, the domestic flying. In fact, the kind of trips that I fly are the ones that start off early in the morning, and I usually get finished by mid-afternoon or so, maybe late afternoon. And that type of flying is probably the least affected by these new fatigue rules. But anyway, so I thought I'd mention that, and I'll keep you abreast of any changes in this new rule and the implementation of it. By the way, airlines have up to 2 years, I believe, to start enforcing these new guidelines and these new rules. So a lot can happen between now and 2 years from now. Okay, electronic devices. Yes, my favorite subject. Okay, as I mentioned, electronic devices, one of my favorite subjects. I received this email from contributor, longtime contributor, First Officer Jeff Falmouth. And he writes, "Captain Jeff, I know your opinion on this, so I can't resist sending this article." And the article that he sent was from the USA Today newspaper. It was an editorial. You may have seen it yourselves. Flyers, think before turning on electronics. And I think they also had some other stories that were also associated with this subject in that same issue of the USA Today newspaper that kind of said the opposite of the editorial. But anyway, so he included a link to that. And he writes, "I've seen a cell phone make the ADF needle spin on an MD-80. Captain made a PA and it stopped." Oh, the power of captains. yeah, well, okay. ADFs, automatic direction finder, I believe is what the ADF stands for. That's an instrument that was used a long, long time ago for, it was a primary navigational aid long before we had cell phones. And it's basically a needle that points to, you tune in a station, and it uses the same frequency as the AM radio stations. And in fact, we still have the ADF receivers on board most airliners, at least all the ones that I've flown so far. Maybe the more modern ones don't, but I think that I think all airplanes still have the ADF instrument in the airplane. And we use it, well, honestly, the thing I think it's most used for is to tune in AM radio stations. You're cruising along and you're bored stiff and you just dial up 750 or 640 or 1110 or whatever, and you can listen to AM radio broadcasts. If you have it tuned up and you are displaying everything properly on your instrument panel, the little needle will point to the radio station from which the signal is emanating. And it's not like you're tracking a radial or a course in or out. You're kind of homing to that station, or it's just kind of pointing to it. So it was kind of a crude way of navigating the airways back in the day before we had VORs and DMEs and other more modern ground-based navigational aids. We also used them to identify outer markers and for instrument approaches and also missed approach fixes and holding points on missed approach procedures on our instrument procedures. But let me tell you what, and you know this, Jeff, I mean, the ADF is one of those instruments that really is not that critical. We don't really use it that much. At least we don't use it for primary navigation. So seeing a ADF needle spin, okay, I'll give you that. You know, maybe it was due to a cell phone, maybe not. I don't know. I've watched ADF needles swing on their own with nobody on board the airplane. No phones on or anything. So I don't know. But anyway, that's interesting that the captain made a PA and it stopped. But again, most airplanes today are not even using the more advanced ground-based navigational aids like VORs. We have the only airplane in our fleet that uses the VOR and, you know, the old-fashioned way of tracking courses inbound and outbound from VOR stations are the DC-9 fleet at ACME, and we're getting rid of those. Every other airplane, every other fleet at ACME use some form of area navigation, what we call RNAV, whether it be inertial navigation systems or global positioning satellite systems, GPS systems, to actually fly our routes. And we use the VORs, the ground-based navigational aids, as backups. And I think these systems also use them to kind of fine-tune their signals. But anyway, he goes on, "Taxiing into JFK last night, I saw an ACME Mad Dog taking off and thought of you. It was 7:45 p.m., so I doubt it was you, since you like the early trips." Yeah, let's see. When did you send this? I don't have a date on it, but it could have been me if I were picking up some extra flying. But you're right. Probably not. 7:45 p.m., that's really dark. Although I do fly during the early morning, and it's dark then as well. But you're right. I do like flying the earlier in the day trips. He goes on, "I'll be reading the new FAA REST papers and look forward to your take on them. My initial reaction is the FAA listened to the carriers and not the crews. Merry Christmas. Well, Merry Christmas to you, Jeff, and I agree. I think that in many ways, the FAA kind of bowed to the airlines in many respects in this new rule. Let's see. Let's talk a little bit more about, you know, this electronic device thing. I have several of you have sent me feedback regarding links to articles and electronic devices and whether or not that they cause any kind of disturbance or interference at all with any of our critical components on the airplane. And most of them say that no, they don't have any effect at all. In fact, what I'm really tired of are these journalists that do something like this. This is something that I clipped back in October, and it's, for some reason I still have it in my Evernote notebook, and it's probably because I never talked about it, but this was dated on the 19th of October, and the headline is this: the FAA says smartphones could imperil safety. Can a phone really put a flight at risk? The FAA insists you turn them off, but some studies show no adverse effects. Okay, really? So I read the article, and basically the article comes out and says the opposite of what the headline does. The FAA does not say that smartphones could imperil. In fact, it says the opposite. So I don't know if these journalists are... Now, I know in journalism, you write an article, and then the editors get a hold of it, and then they come up with the headline. And usually the person that actually wrote the column or the article had nothing to do with the title. So, okay, I'll let them off the hook. But come on, read the article. You know, no, the whole point of this article was that the FAA says that it doesn't really have any adverse effects. Okay. Let's see, there was another one that I was going to talk about. I'm sorry, again, I'm not very organized. I have way too many things on this long list of clips that I want to play or talk about. And where is it? I'll look for the picture, because we pilots like pictures. Okay, let's see. This is the title of this article by Nick Bilton. Disruptions, Norelco on takeoff, fine. Kindle, no. The Times EMT Labs, a testing center in Mountain View, California, measures electronic interference from gadgets to ensure that they meet federal communication standards. And the Federal Aviation Administration has its reasons for preventing passengers from reading from their Kindles and iPads during takeoff and landing, but they just don't add up. And this guy is writing from the New York Times, by the way. He said, since I wrote a column last month asking why these rules exist, I've spoken with the FAA and American Airlines and Boeing and several others trying to find answers. Each has given me a radically different rationale that contradicts the others. The FAA admits that its reasons have nothing to do with the undivided attention of passengers or the fear of Kindles flying out of passengers' hands in case there's turbulence. I've seen that idea posed by several people, including some of you listening. Apparently, the FAA, or whatever spokesman that this person was talking to, said, no, it has nothing to do with that. That leaves us with the danger of electrical emissions. For answers, I headed down to EMT Labs, an independent testing facility in Mountain View that screens electrical emissions of gadgets that need to pass health, safety, and interference standards. Before I share the results of the tests EMT ran, let me explain what this means. Every electronic device throws off electrical emissions. This is the slight hum of energy that emanates from a device when in use. Labs like EMT test electronics of all sizes to ensure that they meet government standards and will not interfere with other electronics when in use. Gadgets are tested by monitoring the number of volts per meter coming off a device. The FAA requires that before a plane can be approved safe, it must be able to withstand up to 100 volts per meter of electrical interference. When EMT Labs put an Amazon Kindle through a number of tests, the company consistently found that this e-reader emitted less than 30 microvolts per meter when in use. That's only 0.00003 of a volt. Quote, the power coming off of a Kindle is completely minuscule and can't do anything to interfere with a plane, said Jay Gandhi, chief executive EMT Labs, after going over the results of the test. It's so low that it just isn't sending out any real interference. But one Kindle isn't sending out a lot of electrical emissions, but surely a plane's cabin with dozens or even hundreds will? That's what both the FAA and American Airlines asserted when I asked why pilots in the cockpit could use iPads, but the people back in coach could not. Yet, that's not right either. Again, from the testing manager at EMT Labs, he is quoted as saying, electromagnetic energy doesn't add up like that. Five Kindles will not put off five times the energy that one Kindle would. If it added up like that, people wouldn't be able to go into offices where there are dozens of computers without wearing protective gear. So basically, the article goes on talking about the fact that these devices are tested and they hardly put out any interference whatsoever. Again, one more in the column of, no, these electronic devices aren't affecting anything. Again, we still have the rule. So that this, even though these articles tend to support this idea that everybody could have their phones and iPads and everything else on in the back, don't do it because the FAA has not changed the rules yet. So you still have to follow the rules. Let's see. Let's look at this one here. Anything else about electronic devices that I want to talk about here? Dun, 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 dun. I apologize for, again, not being organized. No, that's about it. I'm sure I'm going to receive more links to articles that talk about this. But again, as I've always said, I really don't think that that there's really a threat there. Now, okay, let me say one other thing. I don't fly an airplane that's using ADF for navigation, number one. And the other thing is, I have never flown an airplane using GPS to navigate. And I've heard some anecdotal evidence from people that saying that in airplanes that are using the GPS for their primary navigation, they have seen some interference. And, you know, you remember us talking about that company LightSquared, which, by the way, is still having some problems getting its technology approved for use. And they're having to make many, many changes to the devices that are using that spectrum, which is adjacent to the GPS spectrum. A lot of finger pointing going on. LightSquared saying that these GPS devices are being made very cheaply and they don't have any kind of filters to you know, to eliminate any kind of interference there might be. On the other hand, people are saying, well, LightSquared, the company, knew full well before they bid on and were awarded this this frequency spectrum that it was right up next to the GPS spectrum, and there were certain things you had to consider when operating in that spectrum. So, again, a lot of finger-pointing going on, a lot of money at stake, and we'll have to see what happens with LightSquared and their technology. Again, if you don't recall what we were talking about there, it's using a satellite network and using a spectrum that satellites use to beam information down to Earth, and then a terrestrial, in other words, cell towers on the ground, kind of distributing their network signals as well. So it's kind of a hybrid system to get broadband spectrum out there to the places where, you know, it's just not available now, like outside of the major population centers, which is a good thing. You know, don't get me wrong. I'm all for getting bandwidth out there to the people who live far away from population centers. However, I'm not for, you know, risking GPS navigation. And I'm not talking about car navigation. Okay, if I miss a street, that's okay. If I'm in an airplane doing an instrument approach relying on the GPS signal, now it's more important to me. So that's my take on that. And let me read some feedback But before I do that, let me talk about something that I think Brian Padley sent to me, and I had seen it right before he sent it to me. I saw the same article, and I'm trying to find it. I'm vamping right now, and here it is. This summer in Miami, the Miami International Airport. Let me read the article. They say it much more eloquently than I do. Very few people know it, but earlier this summer, two large commercial airplanes nearly collided over the skies of South Florida. This local CBS station in Miami investigated and learned that the close call is part of a troubling trend. In this case, only calm and quick action by the air traffic controller saved the day. And I do have a little bit of audio that we can play. Now, what I'm going to do is I'll include this in the show notes, if I remember. And it's actually a movie, a video, and it has a nice kind of graphic overlay to go along with the audio, and so it's definitely worth looking at. You can kind of see the radar screen along with the audio, and I'm stalling here because for some reason it's not opening up in VLC. Here we go. I think it's about to start.
Miami, Tanua, Argentina, 1302, heavy, crossing 3,000 for 16,000.
We're at the 431, runway 9, or clear for takeoff, lighting 090.
090 on the heading, clear for takeoff, runway 9, American 431.
Argentina 1302 heavy, Miami Tower, good morning, runway 9, or clear to land, wind 140 at 7, caution, make turbulence, departing Boeing 757.
You to land, runway 9, Argentina 1302.
Argentina 1302, you've gone through the final, sir. Turn back right. There's traffic on final for the parallel runway.
Argentina 1302.
Argentina 1302, I see you're not descending. Maintain 3,000, sir. Just maintain 3,000 and turn right heading 090.
Maintain 3,000, I'm currently heading 090, Argentina 1302.
Argentina 1302, when you're able, turn right heading 120.
Enabled, heading 120, Argentina 1302.
Argentina 1302, I need you at 3,000, sir. Climb, maintain 3,000. Your approach clearance is canceled.
3,000, Argentina 1302.
Okay. Looking at the radar returns, again, if you look at this movie, you'll see all this. It looks like when they crossed over the parallel approach course of runway 8 right, the American Airlines flight was on that runway, either 8 right or 8 left, but was one of the parallel runways on the north side. Looks like Argentinian 1302 was just about no more than about 1,000 feet separating altitude separation over the top of American Airlines. And after it crossed that final, it was north of that final, kind of turning back around, and then it was descending. Even though she said the approach clearance was canceled and to maintain 3,000 feet, they were continuing to descend on the approach. Now, was this an approach being hand-flown? I doubt it. What do I think happened here? I think somebody may have dialed up the wrong final approach course. It happens, and nobody caught it, and the airplane was just trying to track the approach course for the other runway, and inaction or delayed action by the Argentina Airlines crew prevented or caused the airplane to get perilously close to the American Airlines flight. And it's pretty scary when you listen to the and I'm impressed with the air traffic controller and how calm she was, and keeping everything under control. So after she told him to maintain 3,000, approach clearance canceled, fly heading 120 when able, she could see that he was continuing to descend, and got that airplane to climb back up and stay out of the way of everybody else. Okay, the article here I'm going to quote from, it was Welsh's voice and calm instructions that kept the two planes from colliding, averting disaster by 900 feet. Okay, so they got as close as 900 feet of vertical separation. She says, at first, you go, oh no. And then you instinctively do something in hopes that it keeps them apart, basically. It was a little scary. When I looked back and saw he had gone through the final, I immediately tried to turn and said, you've gone through, turn back. As I'm saying this, I realize it is too late for that. He's already right where the other aircraft is. Without Welsh's quick and effective action to separate the Airbus at the last second, the Argentina's flight would have descended right on top of the American jet in midair. Would not have been good. Anyway, again, I'll include that video in the show notes and take a look at it. It's pretty scary. So, not sure exactly what happened there, but apparently these people got in a little bit of trouble. My good friend in Portugal, whom I've never met, but I still feel like he's a good friend of mine, Jorge Silva. And he writes, Dear Captain Jeff from Portugal, thanks for your great podcast. I'm a simulator pilot of Airbus 320 series, and we simulate the ATC and all procedures of an airliner on the VATSIM network. So when I hear your podcast, everything is very familiar for me. Looking always forward to hear about a new show. Please keep up the good work and this altruistic thing that you do, sharing your pilot life with everyone who dreams of or likes very much to become a pilot. And in my case, for economic reasons that I can't become an airline pilot, but I will always be dreaming of waiting for that dream to come true. Again, from Portugal, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, if possible, with clear skies and tailwind. Only for cruise, not in landing. Yikes. Best regards, Jorge Silva. Thank you very much for your feedback, and Merry Christmas to you, and Happy New Year as well. And from Down Under, and I'm not going to do an accent because I'm terrible with accents. This from Tim. G'day, Captain Jeff from Sydney, Australia. I've only recently found your podcast after being a big fan of some other similar blogs. Captain Dave at Flight Level 390, in particular, would recommend it to anyone who cannot help but look skyward when they hear something with two wings overhead. Okay, I've not checked out Captain Dave at Flight Level 390, so I'll do that. Anywho, another vote of thanks for your efforts describing the fantastical world you live and breathe. I currently reside in a suburb around 12 kilometers north-northeast of Sydney Airport, the identifier YSSY, and have the pleasure of being underneath of the base leg of approach for runways 16 left and 16 right. The variety of domestic and international aircraft that fly overhead is not overly extensive, but every so often the whine of engines unknown has me running for the window. FedEx and UPS DCs are frequent, and some lovely A340s and 777s have been seen of late. Keeping things brief, I've tried searching both the Catholic Pilot and Airline Pilot Guide podcasts for similar posts, but was hoping you could undertake to relate to us listeners a day in the life of a commercial captain hauling people, bags, and mail all over the United States. It's the small details that help us average Joes understand what it's like for the many people like you who get to head behind the tight security and crawl underneath these birds. For example, the stresses of flying into and out of extremely busy airports, such as Atlanta, JFK, LAX, the procedures and rigor governing the flying, hand flying versus automation, and he puts in parentheses, and is the MD-90, etc., nice to fly? Do you yearn to jump across to the electric jets? I could go on and on. Thanks for your time and your podcast, Tim, from Sydney, Australia. Well, you know, that's a great idea, Tim. And in fact, I was trying to do that. That same idea came to my mind, I don't know, several months ago, maybe more than a year ago. I was just going to kind of record little bits and pieces throughout the day, kind of give you a little bit of a glimpse, like a behind-the-scenes glimpse of my life. And I don't know, I started and I had some recordings and then I don't know what happened to them. I may have deleted them. I'm not sure. So I do plan on doing that It actually might be a mishmash of various days on a trip, or maybe even a conglomeration of many trips put together. But I'll take that on as soon as possible. I think that's a great idea, and I thought it was a great idea as well. So thank you, Tim, for suggesting that I take that on again, and hopefully I'll have something out in the future, a day in the life of an airline pilot. Okay. Some more feedback from my friend Steve. Remember, he sent in some feedback, and I think I read it on the last episode of Airline Pilot Guy regarding the King Air F90 GT that crashed in Midland, Texas. And he writes, I didn't have the opportunity to listen to Airline Pilot Guy number 18 until today. Thanks for the perspective on the December 2nd crash of the King Air F90 here in Midland. I've attached a link to another local news report dated December 19th. Apparently, the NTSB has concluded that ice on the windscreen was the cause of the crash. I'm not a pilot, so I'm just guessing here, but this sounds to me like a problem of not being able to see. Should not the pilot be able to land this aircraft by instruments only? I'm kind of figuring that there must have been some level of pilot error, which is not discussed in the news item. What do you think? And I did review the link, and I don't know. You know, there wasn't really anything that really, you know, came down decisively of why exactly the airplane crashed. I, like you, wondering, okay, ice in the windscreen, you can't see. If so, then why wouldn't you just climb up to an altitude? Maybe he couldn't. Maybe there was a low ceiling and there was no way to get the ice off the windscreen. Again, I'm not an King Air F90 pilot, but I would imagine that they have window heat on those windshields of that type of airplane. And perhaps it wasn't on. I don't know how it formed or why it formed. I don't know. As far as your question regarding the, and of course, if there was ice on the windshield or the windscreen, I think it is very likely that there was also ice on the critical control surfaces and wings of that airplane. So that may have been a pretty significant factor in this accident. Is it possible to land the aircraft by instruments only? No, at some point you have to actually, except for a very, very, very small minority of airline-type airplanes, and maybe some military airplanes as well, and general aviation, business aviation, a very, very, very small group of airplanes out there that can actually land in zero-zero conditions. Most of us, like for instance the airplane that I fly, you can go awfully low, but you have to see something about 50 feet above the ground. And if you don't, then you have to go around. But in this case, I'd be very surprised that this type of airplane had that kind of capability. So it's my guess that this was probably just a Category 1 rated pilot and Category 1 rated airplane. Which means that the lowest ceiling that you can, effectively fly an instrument approach would be about 200 feet above the ground. But that from that point on, you have to see the approach lights and you have to see the runway to get a safe landing. Again, why he didn't, try to climb up and let the ice sublimate so he could see again? Why did the window heat system, if they have one installed, why did that not work or prevent the ice from forming? I don't know. A lot of questions still in my mind why this happened. So maybe some distractions causing him to not pay attention to what the airplane was doing. You know, we have the saying in the flying world, aviate, navigate, communicate. And if you get those three out of order, if you forget to aviate first, in other words, fly the airplane, and you let something distract you, either communications or navigation or whatever, that can be a serious situation. So, hey, Steve, thanks again for the feedback and the update. Let me know if you hear anything else. I'll be curious myself. And let's see. Oh, I got some audio feedback. I love audio feedback. Hint, hint. This from my good friend Matthias. I believe he lives out in California somewhere, but for some reason, he was somewhere near me.
So Matthias here, and I am calling in from the beautiful state of Alabama. I am near Birmingham right now on the road, and I've got a flight-related question for you. Anyway, before we start, I know that you went to school in Alabama, in Auburn, and, well, Captain Jeff, I don't want to be mean to you right now, but I just have two words for you. Roll Tide. Anyway, back to my question. What happens if a pilot loses directions, or can a pilot lose directions? So I am an electrical engineer, so I'm quite familiar with how navigational systems work. But what, for example, happens if you program a VOR point into your flight management system and this system fails? So what do you do then? Do you have any kind of backup plan, or, well, how does it work? Curious to know. Thanks, Father Roderick, yeah. Thanks, Jeff, for all that you do for your Airline Pilot Guy show, for Catholic Pilot, for your Catholic Weekend show. Talk to you soon. Take care. God bless. And bye-bye.
Well, thanks for that slip, Matthias. Father Roderick, I mean, that's quite an honor for those of you who listen to some of the other SQPN podcasts, the network on which I have some podcasts as well. Father Roderick is the founder and CEO of the network, and he does a bunch of different podcasts, and probably the best one is called The Break. You should check it out. He talks about all kinds of things. Don't worry, if you're not Catholic or you're not a Christian, that's okay. His show is still great to listen to. He talks about gadgets and video games and travel and food and you name it. He talks about it, and he's really good at it. And another great one that he does is called Health and Holiness. Anyway, thank you, Matthias, for confusing the two of us. Of course, he laughed after he did that. He goes, oh, yeah, right. So anyway, and regarding your first comment, driving through Alabama and saying "Roll Tide," he said that. Of course, that's the Crimson Tide. Actually, the Alabama Elephants—that's their official mascot—and that is the University of Alabama, which is the big rival of Auburn University, my alma mater. And but that's okay. You know what? Don't tell anybody. But my son, who was a senior in high school, applied to and was accepted by the University of Alabama. And actually, his mom and I have encouraged him that that might be an option for him and for his rule of, or not rule, but his course of study. He's interested in getting into film and also interested in drama and that kind of thing as well. So, but he did also apply to Auburn University and was accepted there too. I know it's a lot harder to get into Auburn, but he made it. and finally, regarding, I think mainly why you sent this feedback, what do we do if we lose, for instance, the flight planned route in our navigation system? And that actually does happen, quite often, but occasionally, once every few months, you look down and all of a sudden you'll see on your electronic flight instrumentation display, EFIS, that you have a map failure or something happened with your navigation system, and it just decided to say, "Up, oh, you're on your own. I don't know where I am." And then you have to kind of scramble to get that thing up and running again and kind of tell it where it is and where we're going and get the route back in and all that kind of stuff. But what you do is you start screaming uncontrollably. You start crying, usually praying. I don't know. I mean, again, I can't speak for everyone. I usually have to curl up on the floor in the fetal position, sucking my thumb. No, I'm just kidding. What we do is we just go back to the way we used to do it. And for those of us who have been flying for some time, we remembered this, and we talked about it earlier in the podcast, the navigational aids, the ground-based navigational aids like the VOR. We tune them up. You know, we pull out our handy charts, which are always readily available. And, okay, we know we're somewhere between, let's say, Atlanta and Birmingham. And we look up the jet route and we dial up, 14-4 for Birmingham. We put in the inbound course. We change our display to indicate the VOR radial, and then we track it. And we do that while we are trying to reload the flight management system, the box, we call it. And hopefully we get that back in order, and then we select navigate, and the thing just starts automatically navigating again. Now, if for whatever reason the VOR system is not working, or we're out of range of a VOR, or we really have no idea where we are, which, that shouldn't happen. But if that were the case, we also have this thing called a radio. And we call up, Houston Center or Atlanta Center or Memphis Center, whatever jurisdiction we're in, and we say, we lost our navigation system, request vectors. And they tell us to fly our present heading, or they tell us to change our heading, et cetera. So, we're always with very, very rare instances, when you're flying in the domestic United States, you're on somebody's radar screen and you're being controlled, positively controlled, the entire time. So it's not like we're, out in the middle of nowhere and we're on our own completely. We're always being watched by and monitored by the air traffic controllers out there. So they take care of you. So that I would say that would be basically the three steps or the three priorities of our navigation systems in modern airplanes. We use the area navigation, the FMS system first, and then if that doesn't work, then we use the backup ground-based navigational aids, and then if that fails, then we just get a heading from the air traffic controllers. So, thanks again for your feedback. Hope that answered your question, and safe travels to you back home. I thought we'd end the show with some humor. This was sent to me by Eugene McVeigh from Northern Ireland, and he sent this to me at the beginning of the month. And let's get on with it. And before I read what he wrote to me, let me tell you again a little bit about the CEO of Ryanair, Michael O'Leary. I've mentioned him several times in my podcast, and he comes up with these thinking way outside the box kind of ideas. He's often chided for some of his wacky ideas, and including myself, I've chided him many, many times. And I'm glad he's out there, though, because I think that he's the source of a lot of entertainment for a lot of us. But anyway, let me read what Eugene sent to me. Dear Captain Jeff, your recent mention of Europe's largest airline carrier, Ryanair, and that of the CEO, Michael O'Leary, brought a smile to my face. Mr. O'Leary's talent for self-publicity knows no bounds. Perhaps this is an airline and a CEO little known to your American audience, but here in Ireland and in the UK, both have become notorious. But fear not, we Irish are very good storytellers. As Hollywood and the rest of the world knows, we know how to deal with humbug and irony in our own special way, even at the expense of a fellow Irish citizen. Enjoy this take on Ryanair's unique marketing approach. Before that, can I say how much I enjoy your podcasts? Yes, especially Catholic Pilot, and I thought your commemoration of 9/11 was a truly wonderful podcast. May God bless you in your work and play. Eugene, and from Northern Ireland. Thank you, Eugene. And he sends Eugene McVeigh, if you want to check him out, EugeneMcVeigh.com. So he's got a website. Now, for Ryanair. Spare a thought for Michael O'Leary, chief executive of Ryanair. Arriving in a hotel in Dublin, He went to the bar and asked for a pint of draft Beamish. The barman nodded and said, "That will be €1, please, Mr. O'Leary." Somewhat taken aback, O'Leary replied, "Well, that's very cheap," and handed over his money. "Well, we try to stay ahead of the competition," said the barman, "and we're serving free pints every Wednesday evening from 6 until 8. We have the cheapest beer in Ireland." "That's remarkable value," Michael comments. "I see you don't seem to have a glass, so you'll probably need one of ours. That'll be €3, please." O'Leary scowled, but paid up. He took his drink and walked towards a seat. "Ah, you want to sit down," said the barman. "That'll be an extra €2. You could have pre-booked the seat, and it would have only cost you €1. I think you may be too big for the seat, sir, so can I ask you to sit in this frame, please?" Michael attempts to sit down, but the frame is too small, and when he can't squeeze in, he complains, "Nobody would fit in that little frame." "Oh, I'm afraid if you can't fit in the frame, you'll have to pay an extra surcharge of €4 for your seat, sir." O'Leary swore to himself, but paid up. "I see that you have brought your laptop with you," added the barman, "and since that wasn't pre-booked either, that'll be another €3. O'Leary was so annoyed that he walked back to the bar, slammed his drink on the counter, and yelled, "This is ridiculous. I want to speak to the manager." "Ah, I see you want to use the counter," says the barman. "That'll be €2, please." O'Leary's face was red with rage. "Do you know who I am?" "Of course I do, Mr. O'Leary. I've had enough. What sort of hotel is this? I come in for a quiet drink and you treat me like this. I insist on speaking to a manager." "Well, here's his email address, or if you wish, you can contact him between 9 and 9:10 every morning, Monday to Tuesday, at this free phone number. Calls are free until they're answered, and then there's a talking charge of only 10 cents per second." "I'll never use this bar again." "Okay, sir, but remember, we're the only hotel in Ireland selling pints for €1. Very, very clever. Turnabout is fair play, right? Okay, well, thank you so much, Eugene, for sending in that humor. If anybody else has some flying humor they want to send to me and have me read, or better yet, why don't you read it, because you'll probably be able to do it with a nice accent, which I can't. That'd be great. And let's see, looking through here, looks like that's about all I'm going to talk about in today's podcast. Looks like I'm long in the tooth again. And so I have some stuff left over for next time. If there's anything that you want me to talk about, any questions you have about flying or travel, send them to feedback@catholicpilot.com, or you can send in your voice feedback to 304-997-4568. That's area code 304-99-PILOT. And if you have a smartphone or some kind of a podcast setup and you want to send me some recorded audio, just send it to that feedback@catholicpilot.com. Oh, you know what I should say? feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. And it all goes pretty much to the same place. And until next time, I hope you have a great week. Continue enjoying the Christmas season. Remember, Christmas just started on the 25th and ends on the 6th of January, the Epiphany. And remember, until we meet again, wishing you blue skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. Take care, and God bless.